Good afternoon. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Our top story today, facial recognition software in schools. Listen and share your thoughts by tweeting to @KUOW. Facial recognition is being piloted right now at one Seattle school through software called SAFER, that's S-A-F-R, at the University Child Development School. Parents of children register their faces, and they can unlock a gate by smiling at a surveillance camera. One of those parents is Rob Glazer. He's the founder of Real Networks, the company that created the software. His kids currently attend the University Child Development School. Rob, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Ross, good to talk to you today.
What's the goal?
The goal is safer schools, would I guess be the short answer. There's obviously a personal element of this for me, and there's also a broader societal element, and there's a commercial element as well. So this is sort of a combination of these three things. Our company, Real Networks, had been working on a product to do facial recognition, which became SAFER. We've been working on it for about 2 years. And last fall, towards into winter, we were starting to get ready to do some tests and trials, and we did them in a number of different commercial places. And literally one day, as I was dropping my boys off at school, I noticed they had a new gate that they'd put up. And so I went inside and talked to a couple of administrators I knew, and I found out that this gate had cameras associated with it, and that the woman, primarily a woman named Angie, who's been with the school for a number of years and knows most of the parents and knows pretty much everybody in the community, Angie's used the camera to identify people. And so I asked innocently, what happens when Angie's on a break or when she's out sick that day? And they said, we don't really know. And I said, well, we've been creating some technology for face recognition. We've been looking for a number of different good uses for this. And would you like to try it in the school? And so I ended up hearing a series of conversations, and ultimately the school decided, yes, it did want to try it. And so we provided the software, as you normally do in a test, for free. And the community embraced it and had a very positive experience with it. And that was sort of percolating along. And then about 2 months later, the tragedy of Parkland happened. And as a parent, and you know, you feel this in your bones, in your gut, whenever one of these tragedies happens. And I have a number of different thoughts, as a lot of people do, about different ways to make school safer. And personally, you know, I'm a personal advocate of sensible gun control and other things. But it seemed to me we had something that actually we could make useful, not just for the school that my kids were going to, and not just for, you know, commercial customers we could get in other markets, but potentially for every school in the country. So we began talking to schools around the country, and it really struck a chord. So we thought, well, let's actually flip this around and say, you know, let's not make the basic product the right focus of our commercial efforts. Let's offer it for free to any school in the country.
Rob, is there an if-then argument for facial recognition in schools? If there was facial recognition, would a shooting have been avoided?
You know, those hypotheticals are super tricky. We decided to call the product SAFER, not, for instance, SAFE. Anybody who tells you that they have a magical way to ensure safety is certainly overpromising. To me, the test is a more subtle one, which is, are we taking a positive step here that could increase safety probabilistically in many cases? And are we doing something that is actually something that the community accepts and feels okay about and hopefully even feels good about? And if the answer to those two questions are yes, then that's, to me, all you have to know in trying to do a statistical analysis of this event or that event, which ones would have been stopped, which ones would have been slowed, which ones wouldn't have been affected. I'm sure that some social scientists will want to do that, but from my standpoint, it's about how do we make incremental steps forward and create a social consensus around those.
Now, as I understand it, at the school here in Seattle, it's parents who are registering and their facial pictures are being taken so that the software can figure out whether they are parents or not. Are all parents participating?
No, the school set it up, I think, very sensibly as an optional opt-in program, and I think that's a good way to go. So if you want to wait for Angie to recognize you and you're not in the system, you're free to do that. And the system is not necessarily applicable for every parent, because during the morning hours, the way the school seems to run, I don't work for the school, but I've taken kids there for 8 years. If you come at the 20-minute window when they've got people at the gate is open, those staff recognize people, and everything's fine. If you come at the 20-minute window at the end of the day, that's the same. But if you come in the middle of the day, your kid has to go to a doctor's appointment, you have to drop something off, the kid forgot their lunch, whatever is going on in the middle of the day, that's when the system comes in. So that scenario doesn't apply intensively to every parent, and so different parents decide whether they wanted to opt in or not, and as my understanding is, about half of them did, which shocked me. I thought it would be maybe a quarter or a third.
Now, it's not being used on students yet, as I understand it, but if it is, how do you integrate a face recognition system that won't make the students feel as though they're under suspicion?
Well, I think if you look at the kind of school, in a grammar school, and the oldest kids at UCDS are 11 or 12, in a grammar school where the kids are as little as 3 or 4 and 12, kids are being picked up and dropped off. So there doesn't seem to be a use case, at least not that this particular grammar school found, to do any facial recognition for kids. So that's the simplest answer. In a lot of cases, for instance, grammar schools, it'll just be about adults. Now when you get to middle schools or high schools, it gets a little more subtle. We don't have any deployments yet in that regard. We literally just announced the product 2 days ago. But I can tell you from conversations we're having, for instance, with the state of Wyoming, and the governor of Wyoming had something nice to say about our product, and the CIO of Wyoming had something nice. They're looking at schools that are schools that have older kids in them. And I don't know whether they're thinking they're going to have a phase where they use it for the kids, so the kids who can come and go, basically it's equivalent to having like an ID card, or whether they're thinking of it in a way that's more like the grammar school. But I think that's going to be something that every school thinks about the needs of their community, thinks about the appropriateness. You know, just like anything else, when your kid wants to play soccer, the parent has to sign a form that says, I know there's injury risk for my kid. So I'm assuming, and there's a lot of regulation that still has to come, in my opinion, that if your kid comes in and says, hey, you know, I want, you know, is my picture going to be in the school yearbook? Some parent has to sign off for that. And similarly, for a system like this, I'm assuming that parents would have the right to opt in or not to whether their kids are going to be registered in the system.
I'm talking to Rob Glazer of Real Networks. He's giving away some software that provides facial recognition to schools around the country. Rob, you're giving away the software. How expensive is it to get the hardware to utilize SAFER, this system?
Well, it depends on the school. In the case of UCDS, because they had just put the camera in, the existing cameras they had worked fine, and they had to do a small amount of work. I don't know what it cost them, you know, a couple hundred dollars to wire the thing that opens the door to the computer that they connected up with it. So it was fairly inexpensive for them. Typically, what you'd need is a pretty new camera. You'd need probably something like an iPad as a registration kiosk, and you need a computer, a Macintosh or a Windows computer, to run the software. So that would be the minimal hardware cost. And then it would just depend on how many cameras you wanted to add. If you didn't have wiring already for the cameras, you'd have to add some wiring for that. And so it's quite scalable up to, you know, start with a very small amount of money up to a significant amount of money.
Rob, you've said you agree we can overdo school surveillance. Why doesn't this qualify as overdoing school surveillance?
Well, hopefully we're starting a dialogue at several levels of our society. We're starting a dialogue at the level of individual schools, at the level of school boards, at the level of, you know, states, at the level of the federal government, as to not just for schools, but specifically for schools, what's the right way to design these systems that enhances safety and does not overdo surveillance. I mean, you know, in my view, I don't want to live in a dystopian world where you walk down the street and you have no privacy. Don't want that at all. It's not my belief that these technologies inherently lead to that, but it certainly is my belief that if these technologies are deployed in an unfettered way, that could happen. So I think we have to have a debate. And Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, by coincidence, we didn't know it was coming, last Friday wrote a brilliant piece about the need for government regulation in this technology, not just for schools, but for the country as a whole. I believe in that. I've said it in an interview or two, I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and I have been for 30 years. So to me, civil liberties are incredibly important. Privacy is one of the civil liberties that's incredibly important. And having the right balance to strike so that you know when you're going into a place that's being monitored, you know it, there's signage. If you're registered in the system, in almost all cases, that would be an opt-in type thing. Those, to me, are the kinds of table stakes, but there's a lot more to do besides that.
Rob Glazer, stay with us. We also have on the line Rachel Levinson-Waldman. Rachel's senior counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Thank you for joining us, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are your thoughts on having facial recognition technology in schools?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll say I am also a parent of young children, so I absolutely appreciate Rob's concern about safety, and I really hear what he's saying about clearly his concern for and kind of attention to civil liberties and privacy. You know, when we're thinking about facial recognition in schools, I think there's sort of writ large two different kinds of systems, and then a lot of breakdown within those. One is what Rob is talking about, right, which is facial recognition sort of at the entrance to a school. Another, which it doesn't sound like is being rolled out here, is facial recognition inside a school, which I think raises a whole host of other issues. So when we're talking about facial recognition you know, at in entrance, right? This, you know, parents are opting in, they have their faces scanned. It sounds like in part it's a matter of convenience. I think really the question is, you know, at the very beginning, the question was, what was the goal? What's the concern? What's the problem that the technology is solving? So if there could be a concern simply about convenience and about sort of what to do, you know, during those times when, you know, as we're hearing, maybe the security guard steps away. So at those points, you know, is there nobody who's sort of acting as that frontline security? You know, if parents are opting into this, they're choosing to have their pictures taken, children aren't being scanned. At that point, what I would think about is, you know, obviously, is this the way that schools want to spend their resources? But I hear that at least in terms of this one, it's free or largely free, potentially depending to some extent on what hardware is already in place. And then I think what I'd really want to think about is some of the issues that kind of attach to facial recognition. So for instance, accuracy, right? We know that a lot of facial recognition systems tend to be quite accurate on white men. That's where a lot of what we call the training data comes from. That's what these technologies are trained on. Less accurate for women, less accurate for people of color. And so even when you see an aggregate percentage of high accuracy, that percentage doesn't necessarily apply to everyone equally, right? So this technology might work differently for different people who are trying to get in.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that. There was a research paper done recently about surveillance and security of students, and it found that schools with more students of color were between 12 to 18 times more likely to adopt strict surveillance like metal detectors and things like this. Rob, do you worry about the use of your software or perhaps over application of your software in a racial way?
Well, I'd say a few things about that. Yes, as a citizen who believes that we need to have a stronger effort to have racial equality in our country, I worry about any technology that would inhibit that or even take us backwards or any use of the technology. We've done some things with SAFER to minimize and perhaps in some cases even eliminate the way the technology could be used in a way that would be deleterious. For instance, we don't do any ethnic or racial identification. Many systems do, and there are algorithms that you can use for that. But we decided we don't want that in our software. So we do gender, we do age, we do a sentiment. We can talk about that. You mentioned the smiling on the way in the door. It's a way to kind of provide some kind of extra authentication, and there may be some other good uses for it. But we don't do ethnicity or race because we, in our view, there were too many pernicious use cases around that, and we didn't want to get involved in that. But that's only a start. I definitely see. I think Rachel's analysis of the difference between a perimeter system like how SAFER is being used and a full-on surveillance system in all the classrooms, etc. Those are two different things. I mean, that's like the difference between a race car and a truck, right? Yeah. They both have internal combustion engines and four wheels, or at least four wheels, but they're totally different. And so, in my view, the use case that we're focusing on is one that's focusing on safety and security, and you know, using the technology, the category of technology. You can overdo it for sure. That's kind of what we're talking about.
Rachel Levinson Waldman, bottom line, Rob has kids in this school. He's provided this software to it. You're a parent with kids in school. What would you feel about if they were putting this facial recognition technology in your kid's school?
So here's what I would want to know if it were going into my school. First, is it opt-in, right? Can parents choose, you know, whether or not to participate or not? It sounds like in this circumstance they can. And then also, more in fact about the accuracy. I hear the point that it's not doing prediction, but I think that's a different matter from whether it accurately matches white faces, faces of color as much as it does white faces. I think also I'd want to know what policy guidelines are there, right? So if the system is doing scanning, is it retaining that information? Under what circumstances? What protections? What encryption are there? Other protections around that quite sensitive data, right? Face prints, face IDs are increasingly valuable. And so wanting to know what protections are in place for those. Are there audits that are occurring of, you know, how the system is being used, if in fact any of it is being retained, who can go back and look at that and under what circumstances? And relatedly, what are the policies and restrictions around access for law enforcement, right? If it's being retained, if law enforcement comes and says, we want to know who's entering at a particular time, what's the kind of bar in place for that in terms of getting some sort of court order or oversight? And then the final thing is some kind of regular community review. So I think one of the concerns here, and you know, Rob mentioned sort of this concern about, you know, we don't want to walk into a dystopian society. surveillance systems, surveillance technologies have a way of proliferating and have a way of being used originally for one purpose and then kind of creeping into more and more purposes, right, once they sort of become normalized. So if there's then a push for, well, right now this data isn't being retained, but maybe down the line it's going to, or right now it's just for entry, but maybe there's a school that's interested in then deploying it inside the school, at each of those points, having expert and community review and input.
Hey, Rob, you've said that the data from local servers at the school it's in now isn't shareable, but in the future, could it be? And what kind of, how would you address those privacy concerns?
I agree completely with Rachel. There needs to be policies at several levels. There needs to be policies at the individual school level. There needs to be policies at the school district level, at the state level, and at the federal level. And there needs to be a dialogue among all the stakeholders. In the case of schools, the students, and they're older, the parents for sure, the administrators, civic leaders, privacy experts, to figure out, okay, what should the rules of the road be? I think Rachel's describing a very sensible sort of framework and set of considerations that should be in place. So we intend to follow up on that. We literally, you know, we launched the product 2 days ago, and I think we launched it in a way that sets it up on a positive arc, but we have hard work to do to keep it on a positive arc and to steer it away from some of the more pernicious or deleterious potential extrapolations if we weren't vigilant.
Rob and Rachel, thank you very much for your time. Rob Glaser, founder of Real Networks, their new software, SAFR, Safer, is facial recognition for schools. It's being piloted here in Seattle. By the way, the Real Networks Foundation is a contributor to KUOW. Also with us, Rachel Levinson-Waldman, senior counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. It's The Record. More tech news in a moment. Facebook plans to release 1 million gigabytes of user information to a researcher. Wait, I think I heard this one. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle Sound Voices, Sound Stories. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. By the way, any reactions to what you just heard about facial recognition software in schools? Tweet at us at KUOW. Anytime you hear something and you'd like to let us know what you think about it, tweet at us. And Bree Ripley's in the studio monitoring social media for us. Speaking of which, cracks began to appear in Facebook's notoriously secret facade after word broke that a researcher they used shared user information and passed it on to a political research company, Cambridge Analytica. There's evidence that Facebook user information was accessed from Russia and from other countries. Well, now Facebook is offering another research organization 1 million, that's with an M, gigabytes of user data to be used to study Facebook's role in society. Here to explain how your data will be used, Karen Wise of Bloomberg Tech, who's written about this. Karen, thank you so much for stopping by.
Sure.
So what is this information on users that Facebook will be sharing?
Sure. So Facebook has, after this big Cambridge Analytica scandal that you talked about, they agreed to kind of engage with academic researchers in a way they haven't before to study how social media affects elections, essentially, initially. And so they have agreed to give anonymized data to this independent research organization that will then do all the academic research process stuff to figure out which researchers should be able to use it and then publish academic papers out of it.
Okay, it's anonymized, so they won't know it's Ross Reynolds' Facebook, but what will they know?
So the first huge data set, this petabyte of data, is based about around URLs, so individual websites that people share on Facebook, and it will, on an aggregate level for each URL that's been shared more than, I think it was about 20 times, will have information about the demographics of users who have clicked on it, the emotions when you click like a little, how many people do the heart versus the, you know, happy face emoji when with a story, if they click on it, if they click on the story, if they share the story, if they comment on the story, if the story is true or false, if it's been rated that way from fact checkers. And the goal of this huge data set is to understand how misinformation is shared and spread and how what kind of impact that could have on elections.
Now, this didn't work out so well last time when it shared it with a researcher. It ended up being involved in the influencing of the American election. What's different now about the sharing of this information?
Sure. So the way the researcher in the past got this information was actually sort of through a back door. Facebook historically has not has been relatively reluctant to share its own data with academic researchers. It has done so, but it does so in a limited way and in a way that it retains a lot of control because it's nervous about its data. So what the Cambridge Analytica scandal happened was this guy used a third-party app to pull data with, in theory, consent, though obviously not as people right. didn't quite realize. So what is different about this is officially sanctioned through Facebook, and it's run through this new group called Social Science One, which is run by a Harvard and a Stanford professor.
That's the researcher that's getting the information.
Yeah. So they are basically pooling this information. They're working with about a dozen different committees of very respected academics to figure out what type of questions they want to know out of Facebook's data. And then they're putting these public RFPs for academics that have to go through their own institutional review boards to get approval for the research. They're doing peer review studies on it to figure out who should get the data, and then they are going to publish on the data too.
So I hear you saying there's more controls, so we shouldn't be worried about this information being misappropriated?
They say, this is all new, so they're developing new systems to do some of this, is that the data will be sequestered in a way where they can literally track every keystroke and every moment of interaction the researchers will have with the data. And Gary King, who's the Harvard professor that was kind of spearheaded this, told me that he knows that if they have one breach, they're done. So they are, to say they're obsessed with the security component of this would be an understatement.
They say, Karen Wise, you know more about this than most of us. Are you concerned personally? Are you on Facebook, first of all?
I am on Facebook.
Okay.
Yes. And I do believe that this is a positive thing. And the reason I say that in general, in that Facebook has tremendous influence on society, on humans, on human interaction, and it's generally been this black box. And so people have had to do all these workarounds to understand how Facebook is impacting so many things and our lives and our happiness and all of this. And so this, a thing that is unique about this is it gives researchers the ability to get access to the original data and then to publish without any restrictions once they find their conclusions. And in the past, the only researchers who had been able to get access to the data had to basically give Facebook pre-approval on publication. And that then raises all these questions about selection bias on the researchers, on what they choose to study, on the topics. And we really need to understand so much more about how social media is impacting our lives as individuals and society. So the reason I think this is positive is it's them opening up to external scrutiny in a way they have been hesitant to do before. That said, from a privacy perspective,
sure.
the onus is on them to prove that they're going to do it right.
What's the public benefit? Someone's listening and they're on Facebook and they're going, oh my goodness, they already did this. This had terrible results. What's in it for me if they allowed all this information to go out? My information, anonymized granted, but my information to go out, well, how's it going to benefit me?
Right. So this basically lets social scientists who study the pressing issues of the day access to this internal information that we didn't know before. So in theory, we could understand better how does fake news spread? And if we understand that, we can understand how to counter it better. We can understand how does social media impact polarization in society? These are huge societal questions that without kind of a rigorous and independent understanding of it, it's really hard to understand how to address them, assuming these are issues that you think is bad. As a journalist, I believe the spread of fake news is a bad thing. I'm happy to say that on the record. So these are all the questions that if only Facebook is looking at them internally and they don't have the external scrutiny that comes with it, a lot of us in the public and the policy field are, you know, our politicians and our legislators are in the dark as well.
Well, will it be as useful as we might like it to? I mean, I'll argue the other side of this. If it is anonymized, I mean, you would kind of want to know whether false information, et cetera, was pushing people in perhaps key areas, key precincts in this country that influenced the election. But we won't know that, right?
They'll have some level of location-related data. They'll have some ideological affiliations depending on what people disclose. They have some information. It's not on a you with your name level, but it's at on kind of a little more aggregate one step up level from that. But in theory, and they intend this to be a global, I mean, the data set is global and they intend it, this initiative, which they're going to keep doing more and more studies from, they intend to be global, relating to ongoing elections in Brazil, I'm sure they'll be looking at the midterm elections coming up.
Now, basically, you think this is a good thing. It'll be good for all of us. Any concerns?
Yeah. One thing is that this group that is kind of facilitating the this data sharing and trying to respect the needs of researchers who want the ability to publish whatever they find, and the needs of Facebook, which is concerned about privacy and their proprietary information. This group is a small group, and it's going to have a big say over what gets studied. And that is both the questions that are being asked and who is asking them. And so I think there's a fair concern to say, is this group a little too U.S. focused? They're trying not to be, and, but they have, but the core kind of thematic committees are largely U.S.-based professors. And they are currently addressing topics that we know are problems, misinformation, polarization, things like that. And so I think it's fair to say that if how in the future will they address the kind of unknown or future problems, anticipate what could be going wrong?
Karen Wise, Seattle-based writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. You can also read her at Bloomberg Technology. Karen, before I let you go, you got a summer read to recommend?
I was just chatting in the green room about this. I recently read Bad Blood by John Carey of the Wall Street Journal. I think the folks coming on soon may talk about it, but it was a journalistic, true crime, corporate crime sort of thing that is just a delicious page-turner.
True crime.
It's like a true beach read, if that makes sense. As a journalist, you got to put a plug in for nonfiction.
Karen Wise, thanks so much for joining us. And stick around. We're going to be talking about your favorite summer reads. Maybe you've got one. Tweet it at us, at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. You're listening to KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. And we're going to talk about sound stories in a moment. What does summer read mean to you? Is it different from your fall, winter, spring reads? Is that because school's out and maybe you're taking time away from work so you've got more time for discretionary reading as opposed to mandatory reading? When summer comes around, are you looking for something light and frothy? Something to read at the beach? Carl Hiaasen, a murder mystery, a romance novel, a true crime novel? Or is summer the time when you dig into that big book that now you have time to tackle? Gravity's Rainbow, Capital in the 20th Century. Do you look for summer reads that will put you more in touch with the world? Or are you looking for something to read that will take you away from the world we live in? I'm asking today, what makes for a good summer read and why? You can call us at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. Or you can tweet at us at KUOW. KUOW's youth media program, Radioactive, hit the streets of Seattle to ask for the wisdom of the crowd.
What's your favorite beach read and why?
I like reading historical fiction on the beach because then it's like, since there's nothing really out there except for the water, you can really easily visualize like the battles or like the speeches taking place.
I like, I guess, Pride and Prejudice. It's kind of silly, it's lighthearted.
I think I would read a book about geology of sand, about the evolution of that beach and like how the minerals on that beach originated there.
I can't give you a title or an author, but I can tell you this much. It's got to be very, very easy reading, definitely a girlfriend book, and usually it's something about a southern woman in her escapades.
A girlfriend book. Got to be a girlfriend book. Do you have a summer read that you'd like to suggest to us, or are you looking for a good book to crack open on the beach? We have two voracious readers here to help you figure out what you need to read, and you can ask them for recommendations by calling us at 206-543-5869. Come up with a genre or an area, and I'm sure these guests will have a book for you. They are Zoe Fisher, writer, lecturer, and librarian at Pierce College, and Tom Nisley, author of A Reader's Book of Days. He also owns Finney Books. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Ross.
Thank you.
Let's start out with your definition of a summer read. What do you think about when you hear summer book or beach read? Zoe?
I think it can be any genre, but it needs to be a book that gives the reader pleasure and escape. You know, lots of people are traveling over the summer, so you might be on a long car ride or on a plane. You need a book that really grabs you and enthralls you. And it might also just be something that helps you relax while you're at home during a staycation.
Tom, does it have to be an easy book?
Not necessarily. I think when I think of beach reads and when I pack for the beach, I think of time and something that I don't have the rest of the year, so that I can actually dive into a book, whether it's an easy book or a hard book, where I can actually give it the attention that I just don't have the rest of the year.
So give me an example of each of those, something that you is on your bookshelf right now that you're reading, Tom.
Well, when I went, I had a week at the beach last month. It was very washy. It was 60 degrees and drizzly, so I did a lot of reading.
There's Washington beaches for you.
Yeah, and I'd been wanting to tackle. What I actually did was I usually read ahead. I'm trying to keep up with what's coming out. I went back and read stuff that people at our store have loved that I hadn't read. So I started Rachel Cusk's trilogy, three novels, Outline, Transit, and Kudos. And the third one just came out, so now I feel like I can read them all. So it was my chance to dig into something bigger. And I read the first one, Outline, and I loved it.
Zoe, what's your summer reading, and are you enjoying it?
Yes, I was just in New York City over the weekend. I went to the Strand, and I bought Virginia Woolf, A Room of One's Own, and the new Terrence Hayes book of poetry. So to me, poetry and fiction are pleasurable reads, and that's why I love reading over the summer.
I don't know if I intended it to be summer reading, but with Philip Roth's passing, I picked up Sabbath's Theater, which I never read before, which is kind of trashy and fun, actually. It actually feeds into a summer read. What's your summer read? 206-543-5869, or are you looking for a summer read recommendation? 206-543-5869. Zoe Fisher, writer, lecturer, librarian at Pierce College, is with us, as is Tom Nisley, author of A Reader's Book of Days, and you may have run into him if you've ever gone into Finney Books, because he owns that. So let's talk a little bit about the element of guilty pleasure in a summer read. And I think I know where you're going to go on this. Is it a guilty pleasure? Is a summer read the kind of a book that you're really going to enjoy, but maybe you don't want people to see the cover of, Zoe?
You know, as a librarian, I think we don't judge what people read. As long as you're reading, I'm happy. I think that anything that makes you excited, makes you want to crack open that spine and read that book, you shouldn't feel bad about it. And one of the principles I think about a lot as a librarian is that every book has its reader. You know, there's either a book you like or you don't like, and you shouldn't feel bad about it.
How about you, Tom?
Yeah, I totally agree. Booksellers are like librarians. We don't judge. I think I thought of this recently. My wife called me up and said, bring me home something fluffy. And I know her well enough that she actually doesn't want something fluffy. She wants something that involves her. If she thinks it's stupid, she's not going to like it. Mm-hmm. So what she wanted was something that she could sink her teeth into, that read easily but yes, wasn't stupid, I mm-hmm. think. My favorite book like that recently, that one of our other booksellers just discovered, it's about 20 years old. It's Australian. It's called The Women in Black. And it's a Christmas story, so maybe wouldn't feel like it's right for this time, but in Australia, summertime is Christmas time, so it's actually a summer story. And it's about women who work in a department store in Sydney in the 50s, and it is a comedy, and it is the most charming, delightful book I've read in years. It doesn't want it to be anything but a comedy, and it wraps everything up in a neat bow just the way you want it to. And so that's the one I've been handing out at the store.
See, women working in a department store in Sydney, everything wrapped up in a neat bow, mm-hmm. not like the world today,
yes.
in the least. very different from the world today. And that kind of gets to the question of is the ideal summer read something that brings us closer to the world or kind of gives us some respite from the world, the way a summer vacation does? What do you think, Tom?
Well, I think, it's a story about female empowerment. So I think you could read it and feel like it is about the world we live in today, but it's kind of a better world than we live in today. So I think it has a little of both.
Sure.
And that, to me, that's kind of the ideal.
We're going to get to Jeff, who's on the line, in a moment. We're at 206-543-5869. Tell us about your summer read, or if you'd like a recommendation from Zoe or Tom, I'm sure they can come up with one for you. How about that, Zoe? Does a summer read for you bring you closer to the world, take you away from the world?
When I was thinking about memorable summer reads from my childhood and my past, they were fantasy. So Harry Potter is a big one for me. You know, those books were always published in June or July when they came out. Harry Potter's birthday is July 31st, so I really associate the Harry Potter books and that sort of fantasy and magic and escape with summer, and I think that's totally appropriate. I also love the Dangerous Angels series by Francesca Leah Block. They're set in sort of a fantasy version of Los Angeles. Weetsy Bat is one of those books, and it's being adapted into a film, which I'm very excited about. So for me, when I think of summer and I think of summer reading, I think of escape and worlds that are a little more magical and less real than our own.
Summer reads, looking for things to take to the beach or the hammock, 206-543-5869. We've got Jeff on the line. Jeff, do you have a question about a summer read, or do you have a summer read you'd like to share with us?
I have a summer read recommendation, actually.
Okay. What's that?
It's a book called Sea of a Thousand Words. It was written by a local author named Christine Wallace.
Sea of a Thousand Words.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And why
and
is
it's
it
her,
a,
it's her. Why
is it a, why is it a good summer book?
Well, first off, it takes place here in the Northwest, so it's great for this region. It's a sort of a climate fiction refugee kind of science novel, science fiction kind of novel. But it's really fast and gripping. It really, you get into it and you can't put the book down. It's so enjoyable.
That sounds like a great recommendation. Have either of you heard of that book?
I'm writing the title down right now.
All right. You stumped the panel. Good work, Jeff. Thanks for your phone call. We're at 206-543-5869. Following Jeff, we have Jeffrey on the line. Jeffrey, thanks for your phone call today. Do you have a recommendation for a summer read, or are you looking for a summer read?
Hey, I'm looking for a summer read.
Okay.
I enjoy David Grisham and David Baldacci.
Okay.
And kind of those CIA-type thrillers. And I was wondering if you had a recommendation of a similar genre but a different author.
All right. Summer recommendation for people like Baldacci, that kind of mystery thing. What do you have to suggest, Tom or Zoe?
There's a spy series, and I'm blanking on, Jason Matthews.
Jason Matthews.
Yeah,
okay.
And the first book in the series is called Red Sparrow. It's about Russia and the U.S. I think he worked in the CIA for decades. He knows what he's talking about. My father-in-law, who has read bookshelves of those kinds of books, said it was the best spy book he's ever read.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a national security. There's a movie. It turned into a movie.
I thought that was a
right.
movie.
And
yes.
Now I think the three books are out in the series. So very contemporary. It might feel maybe too contemporary, but no, that's been my book to give out.
Did you see the movie?
I haven't seen the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you have to recommend, Zoe, for someone who that taste of spy novels?
Yeah, if someone is interested in crime and murder mystery and maybe likes a darker story for summer reading, the book that I can't stop thinking about is I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. She's a spouse of Patton Oswalt. She passed away in April of 2016, and she's a true crime writer, and she was obsessed with the Golden State Killer in California, finding who he was and bringing him to justice. And tragically, they did find him this April of this year.
After her book came out.
And so, yeah, her book was published in February. They found the killer a couple months after that. But if you're like me, you can avoid spoilers by reading the whole book first and then go and look up the details of the case and read the news stories from April of this year. It's, it's grisly, it's dark, but also there's something about it being set in California, these beach communities. We think of California as this sunny vacation place, but there were these grisly rapes and murders committed there. And Michelle McNamara was obsessed with this case, had, knew every detail about it, wanted to find out who this guy was. And it's really gripping and really exciting. So if you like true crime or murder mystery, I really recommend it.
That's great. Hey, Jeffrey, by the way, you can put down your pencil. We're actually compiling this list and all the books we're talking about are going to be online and available for you to take a look at. So if you're listening and you hear something that catches your ear, we'll have it for you. You can come check us out later. Does that help, Jeffrey? He's gone. Let's go to Paula next. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. We're talking about summer reads. Paula, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Are you looking for a recommendation, or do you have a recommendation?
I'm actually looking for a recommendation.
All right. What do you like?
I like biographies. I've read plenty of people biographies, but I'm kind of focusing now more on animal biographies, like famous pets.
Famous pet
like
biographies.
Grumpy Cat.
Well, very specific recommendation here. A pet biography about a grumpy cat. Okay.
Oh, I know Grumpy Cat meme, and I actually think I have a book that she might like.
Okay, Zoe, what is it?
I put this in the genre of book that I call the self-congratulatory liberal parent picture book, and it's called A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo. It is a picture book about the bunny rabbit that belongs to the Pence family, and it is sort of a satire of this bunny that belongs to Mike Pence. And it turns out the bunny is gay. He likes another boy bunny and he wants to get married, but the mean, evil stink bug says he can't get married to the boy bunny that he loves. It's very sweet. It's very silly. The illustrations are very funny. It's called A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo.
No politics there.
Yeah.
purely metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, there's a
pet biography, though.
Does that help, Paula?
Yes,
Thank you very much.
You betcha. Tom, there's a book we wanted to get you to talk about. It's called Hope Never Dies.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So I hadn't actually, it came out pretty quickly. I hadn't heard about it in advance, but as soon as I saw the cover, I knew I had to get a stack of them.
And what's on the cover?
The cover is a picture of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. Biden is driving a convertible, and Obama is standing up through the roof, and he's pointing at something, you know, it looks like out of the Rockford Files or something. And it is described—
A detective novel with—
Yes, it's the first, quote, Obama-Biden mystery. And I guess the guys have a lot of time on their hands, so now they can solve crimes. And it is just, the tone of it is so spot on. The picture, the idea. So I haven't heard back. We sold a lot. I haven't heard back from anybody who's read it, whether it holds up the whole way through. But I love the idea.
Well, have you read Hope Never Dies? Give us a call, 206-543-5869. Does it live up to the cover? Give us a call and tell us, or give us a share with us one of your favorite summer reads. With us, Zoe Fisher, librarian at the Pierce College, and also Tom Nisley, owner of Finney Books. We're at 206-543-5869. We ask listeners on our social media accounts for their summer reads. Erica Sampson got back to us on Instagram. Her summer read is The Elephant Whisperer by Lawrence Anthony. She writes, I'll be traveling to South Africa for the first time, and this book has inspired me to step out of my comfort zone with where I will be going, planning on going to the Thula Thula Reserve when I get there, end quote. Thanks for sharing that with us, Erica. And what a great genre to think about when you're traveling, books about the place that you're going to. What comes to mind when I prompt you with that, Tom? Hmm. A book that you can really enjoy if you are going to a particular place.
Last year I was lucky enough to go to Spain for the first time.
Yeah.
So I read Javier Marías, who's I would say is the best known Spanish novelist. Really well known there, not as well known here. So I tried one of his books, A Heart So White, and loved it. It's set in Madrid and Cuba, and it's not the kind of atmospheric historical where you feel like you're walking the streets of Madrid, but psychologically, I felt like I was getting to know Spanish people. And so that was my
favorite. Zoe, how about you? An idea for a great book if you're going to some place that'll really give you a sense of that place.
Well, I mentioned I was just in New York City, and about a month ago, I had the pleasure of listening to the audiobook of Tonight I'm Someone Else by Chelsea Hodson. Mm-hmm. She's an essayist. She writes, creative nonfiction. She's based out of Brooklyn, and her essays cover a wide range of subjects that include, being a model in New York City, but she grew up in Arizona, went to college there, and there's just something about her voice that's really mesmerizing physically, but also her word choice. And it just makes you think about what it's like to be young and be an artist and, live in New York City and try to find yourself. This book, I think, really simmers. And if you can listen to it on audiobook, it's available through the Seattle Public Library. Her voice is really lovely to listen to. It sounds like it could make water sweat on a glass. You know what I mean?
A voice that could make water sweat on a glass.
She has a great voice.
That New York City prompted me to think of the book that should be on my summer reading list, The Power Broker, Robert Caro, about Robert Moses, the person who really shaped the city of New York. It's been constantly cited as a masterful work in the exercise of power. And, of course, Robert Caro has gone on to write the three-volume, I think going on four or five volume, history of Lyndon Johnson, just an amazing history writer. We're talking about summer reads, 206-543-5869. And if you'd like to weigh in on our questions, do you read in the summer to get away from the world or to get into the world? 206-543-5869. You can tweet at us at KUOW. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bonnie on the line. Bonnie, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
Do you have a book you want to tell us about, or are you looking for a book?
I'm looking for a recommendation. I'm leaving this weekend on a couple-week trip to Italy and France in the south and looking for something to kind of peruse through my time. I like things like Gone Girl or The Hunger Games. Like I said, I'm not really an avid reader, but, yeah, just something that's kind of gripping or interesting.
Okay, a trip to Europe. Some suggestions for something to read? Zoe, you're eagerly
Yeah, the novel that I can't stop thinking about right now is the latest Oprah's book club pick. It's called An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. I don't know if you like letters in books, but I love those, epistolary books where there's letters back and forth between the characters. That always really gets me into a story. And this one's really gripping. It's about newlyweds Celestial and Roy, who are facing an uncertain future when Roy is sentenced to 12 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. He's released after 5 years of incarceration, but he has no idea what his marriage is going to be when he returns home. These are characters that really get into your head. They're very complex and layered, and I think the premise is really exciting. And the author, Jones, said that she was inspired to write the story when she heard a couple arguing at the mall, and the woman said, "I wouldn't have waited 7 years for you, Roy." And she was also inspired by the book The Odyssey, you know, this idea of a husband who has a long journey home and just wants to find a faithful wife waiting for him, but Celestial is no Penelope. So I think that if you like gripping fiction and exciting stories, this will really satisfy you.
Thanks. Bonnie, hopefully that helps for you too. 206-543-5869. We've got a few minutes left. Zoe mentioned audiobooks. Tom, is an audiobook that comes to mind that's a great summer listen?
Yeah. And one request that we get quite a bit is not for the beach, but for getting to the beach, is for families who are driving together, who have a long road trip ahead. They want an audiobook that they can all listen to together. So, you know, we've done the Harry Potter books, and those are fantastic as audiobooks. The one that came to mind for me is our favorite, E.B. White's The Trumpet of the Swan. Mm-hmm. So not his best-known book. It was his last kid's novel. The best thing about it is that he reads it, mm-hmm. and he has, as you might expect, he has this wonderfully dry Maine accent. So just hearing him say, there's certain lines from the book that we just recite as a family. So Montana, banana, banana. I can't do a Maine accent, but it's a good story, but it's just, you feel like you're with him, this kind of crotchety, good-humored old guy who's telling this story. So that's
a word of favorite. Advice about audiobooks. My wife and I went on a trip with her father and his wife, and we thought Mambo King's Sing the Songs of Love would be a wonderful book to have because we loved that book. I think E.G. Marshall, TV guy, was narrating it. And we got to these points where he was talking about his throbbing muscle in these explicit sex scenes, and it didn't really come out quite right for that car trip. So check out what it is that you'll be listening to.
You're safe with E.B. White.
You're safe with that. Let's go to another phone call. We've got Gigi on the line. Gigi, do you have a recommendation or are you looking for a suggestion?
Well, both. I wanted to recommend a book I just finished, Last by Andrew Sean Greer. It was wonderful. It won the Pulitzer, but it's a great book for summer because you can read it just for the story. It's really funny and lovely and sweet, but it's also so incredibly well written, so that if you read it more closely, you'll see the genius of his writing. It's just wonderful. And then I wanted a recommendation for a new thriller.
Okay, what's that?
I loved The Woman at the Window. What are some others? The Woman in Cabin 10. It doesn't have to have Woman in the title.
I was just going to ask, does it have to have Woman in the title?
They all do these days.
They all do these days.
This is more of a secondhand recommendation, which is what I do a lot as a bookseller, since I can't read everything. But the one that I've been wanting to read that we've had a lot of interest in is, it's called The Dry by Jane Harper. And I seem to be reading a lot of Australian books, some of my favorite writers these days. So it's another Australian book. It's, I think, her first novel. She's had another one come out, but that's been first time. It's kind of a suspense thriller, I think, like the ones you described, and that's the first on my reading list.
I was in Australia. I just read The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes, an amazing history of the creation of Australia. Hey, thanks a lot for your suggestions, Gigi. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Zoe Fisher, writer, lecturer, and librarian at Pierce College, thank you so much for stopping by. We appreciate it. Tom Nisley, author of A Reader's Book of Days and owner of Finney Books, thank you for stopping by too. And we've collected all these books, so you don't have to have written them down. Mm-hmm. Go to kuow.org/record to find our list. It's not going to be there right now, but it'll be there shortly. That's kuow.org/record to find the list. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Tomorrow on The Record, we're going to take take a look at the changing face of homelessness. Bill's back on Monday, and maybe he'll tell us what he's been reading while he's been on vacation. The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. Bernard Ouellette is in control. I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is The Monkees. You bring the summer.